Alabama State University's Biomedical Research and Training Program and the Tropical Pathology and Infectious Disease Association have teamed up for the second year to allow students to train in Peru. WVAS News reporter Melanie Hogan explains the program.
In December of 2013, ASU students dubbed the Magnificent 10 traveled to Peru to gain on-the-job experience in the medical field. Dr. Elaine Rowling is the founder of the Tropical Pathology and Infectious Disease Association, also called TPADA.
I want to be a heart surgeon, an astronaut, or a fighter pilot. That was my dream. I used to lay on the grass and look up at the stars. I knew all the constellations, how far the distance, planet, Pluto, Uranus, and you never know in life, you know, and so you just dream and you just go about life playing football and all that stuff. And then when I got to college, you know, I wanted to be a fighter pilot. I'm pretty bright. And so I had an Army scholarship, four-year ROTC scholarship. I was one of the first black people to get one, win one. And man, I was in the Army. I said, you know what? Then the Marine Corps said, hey, we'll take you. I said, okay, I'm going to switch from the Army to the Marine. And the Marines just came out with the F-18 Hornet fighter plane. I was going, ooh, I'm gonna get jets. Man, I was so happy, man. I was like, oh, this is my dream. I took the flight exam and my eyes flunked me. So they said, you can be in the back seat of it. I said, oh, no, I'm not going to be sitting back there shooting weapons and stuff. I want to fly the thing. And I said, you know what? My love was always science, microbiology, diseases. And so that became my jet. That became my football, my microbiology. And then, you know, one thing leads to another. And you never know in life, because I know for our generation, for me and Dr. Gunn's generation, we didn't really have people like me and her to look up to know things. I remember the white kids would be meeting in the back of the room at Weber State in Utah. And I walk in there and they all scramble like cockroaches. Wait, what's going on? Nothing. We ain't never going on. But these guys meet and talk and have an exposure. And us black folks, you know, we go through life. We have to touch the fire to get burned to realize that, hey, you can't touch the fire. It's hot. And so, you know, you go through life. You go through microbiology. You graduate. You know, I got into a PhD program and a master's program in molecular biology. I always wanted to go to medical school. I went and got my master's degree in molecular biology. And then I knew there was opportunity for me to go to medical school. And the military said, make it happen. And so the military was very good to me. And they made me who I am from discipline, determination, dedication. And, you know, I took advantage of every opportunity the military has. And when people look at my CV, there's a reason why my CV is the way it is. And people look at it and go, my God, there's no way this guy's done all this stuff from airborne, pathfinder, scuba qualified, you know, C4, all this stuff. But because people told me what I couldn't do when I was a kid, I have a psychological problem when I was younger, and I had to be the best of the best. I can't be average. There's no way for me to be average because I'm not allowed to be average. Tiger Woods cannot be average. Michael Jordan couldn't be average. The white kid comes, he can sit on the bench and develop for 10 years. As black kids, we got to play. Now, we don't get the second opportunity. So, and I'm a product of the system. I'm a product of the real world of America. From there, I learned, I saw, I experienced, I failed, I was positive. I had all the successes. I understood that no matter how intelligent you are in life, I thought in America, you become a doctor, you become board certified. I used to write the questions for the certification for surgery, and I used to certify people in surgery on an oral committee. At the end of the day, it doesn't mean anything, because I had guys that I certified in surgery would try to testify against me saying I was doing something wrong. And that's the hypocrisy of the system. And then you learn that, and then it's not about you being intelligent, and you find out that I know for me, to have the white guy over me, I got two more degrees than he does, more qualifications than he does, and this guy's sitting up here trying to evaluate me, telling me I have a problem with communication. And that kind of builds on your psyche, and you learn from that. And the only way I've learned is that we learn from on-the-job experience. You got to go through life. You have to feel things. You see it. You fall down. You pick up. And if you get lucky to make it to the second half of our lives, you're a pro. You've seen it all. Nobody can tell you anything anymore. You don't have to worry about you trying to be validated by society. You validate yourself, and you do your own thing. Because at the end of the day, when you look in the mirror, the only person you're looking at is yourself. because society will use you and throw you to the side. And what I learned is that with all the skills and knowledge and that God's given me and the hard work I've done and be able to live in Germany 4 years, in Japan, and teach surgery in Barcelona, I went to a country called Peru and I followed my calling again. You know, to operate on a little baby and the mother's in the OR crying. You fix this baby and the baby lives and survives and you do good work and all the doctors in there says, my guy, you're good at what you do. You find your compassion again. You find your cup of tea. It becomes your motivation, becomes your energy. And then your car gets driven this time in the second half of your life, and this time you don't look back. The rear view mirror is broken and you move on. And then I figure that what I've gone through in my life, in my career, and my sister's an OB doctor, and my mother's a nurse, we've seen that side of what you think is being intelligent is not intelligent. Because you have a lot of incompetent people in medicine that are there because their buddy is a great, great uncle of Jed from Boonville, Louisiana. And you find out that you have to create your own thing. And so I wanted to make sure when I had the opportunity to give back, and I've always been a person of education, is that I want to make sure that the next generation of doctors and scientists and nurses and PAs are better than me. And the way we do that is to teach them, expose them to opportunities that Dr. Gunn didn't have, I didn't have, where people will say, come here, let me show you what a neonatal unit looks like. Let me show you what surgery looks like, what it smells like. Let me show you why you have to study organic and inorganic chemistry for anesthesia, and you understand what the sodium potassium pump is. My God, what would have happened if Dr. Gunn and I and all the other black generation 30, 40 years ago would have had the opportunity to do Tepeda like these young black kids are doing today? What would we be today? It's unbelievable. And so we do the program. I've developed it since 2004 to train the next generation of doctors and nurses and healthcare people and to try to teach these kids about understanding what compassion is and not being an ambassador to themselves, but being an ambassador to the world. And because if you really sit back and think about it, one of the greatest gifts you can have is to be able to affect somebody else's life. It might not be the fact that you might not be the doctor, but maybe you understand. Maybe it's like Dr. Gunn and Mrs. Davis holding the lady's hand in the OR praying while she's crying while we're cutting her foot off. You know, the compassion, understanding how an individual of a unit, you change the dad's life, you change the whole dynamics. People become poor. Oh, my God, you know, I never knew that your mother had a stroke and it's your mama's problem. No, it's the whole entire society's problem. And we fail to realize that.
First, describe the sights and sounds of Peru.
Our program is centered in Iquitos, Peru, but also in Cusco, Peru. We're in two locations. We're in the Amazon basin in Iquitos, in the heart of the Amazon. You can't get any more jungle. It's more jungle than Africa. And then we have Cusco, Peru, which is in the mountains, which is one of the seven wonders of the world, Machu Picchu. You know, 50 million people visit it, Machu Picchu, every year because it's one of the seven wonders of the world. And so that's what we're based at, in the jungles and also Cusco. I also work for the Catholic Hospital. I operate on all the nuns and the bishops. Isn't that amazing? A black guy like me operating on these 85-year-old sisters, black man. The Catholic Church sends me their bishops and nuns to operate on in Cusco at the oldest hospital in America. The hospital's been there for 456 years.
What was it like to have ASU's Magnificent 10 work in Peru for 11 days?
To me, it's like me. Fast pace, gas burning in the car, running. 20-hour days to see the look on their face, the apprehension, the unknown, like I always say, to some of these kids have never flown before, and they have that experience learning about themselves. But I think at the end of the day, the Magnificent 10, I think what they learned and seen from their apprehension, at the end of the day, they learned from me, you got to have faith in life. You got to take a chance. You got to get out the boat sometimes. The people that sit in the boat in life, they never go anywhere. The guys that get out the boat, you got to go for it. And when you get out that boat, you got to go all the way. And most of the time, Dr. Gunn will tell you now, in my world, you get out that boat, you ain't coming back.
The trip was in December, but it was far from a vacation. These students really worked some long hours.
Absolutely. I think one of the things of the program, you know, we try to take the kids, we expose them to all the different specialties. And we expose them to not just medicine, we also expose them to science, sociology, economics, the impacts of diseases. They have to write a paper, an abstract, to start understanding science. Because I tell the students that you cannot separate medicine from science or science from medicine, or you can't separate education from economics. Because when you cut a patient's leg off, there's a psychological problem there. There's an economic component there. There's a sociology component there. And so when students are going to school, they have to be students of all areas, aspects of education. And also the fact that we take these kids and they go through surgery, and we teach them how to sew. The chief of surgery are teaching the kids how to do suturing. The chief of anesthesia shows them anesthesia. The chief of OB, the chief of neonatal, the chief of infectious disease, the chief, taking their time, roll their sleeves up, and teaching the next generation that, guys, you can do this. We're normal like you. We laugh like you. And these kids, they do these 20-hour days, and they find out about themselves at 2 o'clock in the morning when the baby dies and the mother's crying. They find their moment, and they do this for 5 days, and then we're pushing them, and we're working them, and they're working 20-hour days, and I ask them, are you tired? And they look at me, and they say, no, I'm not tired, Dr. Rowland. Are you sure you're going to quit on that baby? And then they go, no, I'm not going to quit. And they get back to the hotel, and I say, okay, guys, it's 8 o'clock. We got a spin class. Let's go for it. We're going to go work out for an hour. Are you going to quit? And they come and they do it, and it's hot. And they get off the bike, and then the next day you look into the gym, and the students are in there doing spinning on their own. They start learning philosophy. And then we take them to the jungle. And then we walk, get out the boat, and they got to walk 6 miles, 2-3 hours to the jungle with machetes, and it's hot, and the unknown again, the fear. And then they go 5-6 miles, and all of a sudden they see a little child running up to them out of the jungle because they know that we're coming. And they get their energy again. They get their motivation again. And so it's an evolutional process. So when we get done with these students and they come back to their individual institution, this particular one, they're different people. They're different human beings. They're more motivated. You talk to the professors, they tell all the kids that have come back from the PETA program, you know, the best students, their focus, they know what it is. And one of the things that Tepeda, we have had our students that have done our program in 10 years. I have one of my students, I call him my babies. He's in his cardiothoracic surgery residency program at Mount Sinai in New York. I have one of my babies, MD, PhD at Duke. I have one of my babies at MD, PhD, Cal Davis. I have one of my babies, orthopedic trauma, Mayo Clinic, my baby at Baylor at Utah, Baylor at Wisconsin. Baby, we have our babies out there now. And I can guarantee you, listen to me, Alabama State, these group of students right now, I know you got a neurosurgeon coming out of here, you got a pediatric surgeon coming out of here, you got three OBs coming out of here, you got a neonatal coming out of here, neonatologist coming out of here. Mark my words. In 10 years.
How did you keep the students safe? What safety measures did they follow so they wouldn't contract or spread disease once they returned home?
Well, the disease that we deal with are diseases that they learn in the book. And one of the sad things of American education has changed so much from when me and Dr. Gunn were students 30 years ago, because I remember being in immunology doing heart sticks on rabbits and injecting eggs with viruses to look at the, you know, the cytopathic effect. Nowadays it's so clean you can't do anything. So our students in the United States can't compete with all the students in the rest of the world, because that's why we're like 34th in science and mathematics, because we're so clean now. Our students know book sense, but they don't have no practical application. When I first went to Peru, it's one of the reasons why this thing started. I had a patient that had tuberculosis. I mean, my God, you have a patient that has tuberculosis. This is a real patient, TB. This is not in a book. guys, let's go down to the room. We go down to the room. I tell the students, patient spit into a cup. The patient spits in the cup. Guys, we're going to go do a basic acid fast stain on a real tuberculosis patient. We go to the laboratory. I say, students, make it happen. And my microbiology students couldn't do an acid fast stain in front of the Peruvian doctors and students. So I had to do the acid fast stain for them. I do it. Okay, I get the stain from. I put the slide under the microscope. I said, come over here, my students from the U.S., and tell me what you see. They look into the microscope, and they couldn't see the bacillus. I had to show them what it looked like. We have a problem. And so this is the connection, getting the kids out of the academic classroom and giving them practical application when they put it together. But the diseases they're exposed to, they see HIV. They see syphilis. They see dengue fever. They see leishmania. They see cholera. They see snipe bites. They see tuberculosis. They see, I tell people, it's the biggest petri dish in the world, Peru. You can learn so much there. Students are exposed to it. The students don't get sick. They don't get in contact with diseases. They don't pick the diseases up because our immune system is pretty good. And we have good universal precautions. When we have to wear a mask, a patient has multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis, the students wear a mask. If the patient has a disease, they put gloves on them. But the bottom line, at the end of the day, this is the best exposure for the individual students. Some of the diseases that the students got to see in December that Alabama State are talking about and writing about and what they're going to present, the students wrote a paper, an abstract on neonatal with syphilis. They had another patient that had neonatal with dengue. They had another patient, baby, that had neonatal with malaria. We had another neonatal that had a toxoplasmosis. And these are the cases in real people, real patients. So I tell the students, if you understand the disease, you understand the science. And if you understand the science, you understand the medicine. What better example than that to get kids to actually see it? Because if you see it, you smell it, you'll never forget it.
Some of the students participated in surgeries, amputations, and deliveries. Explain the benefit of mixing academics and experience on this level of schooling.
It gets the kids out of the tunnel vision. It gets them out of the tunnel vision. Now what happens is that now they can see it. They can smell it. Okay, this is the reason why I'm studying organic chemistry. The reason why you're studying organic chemistry, and my anesthesia guy sits down and tells them the basic molecular reaction to anesthesia. Wow, it makes sense. Wow, okay, in the surgery. Okay, this is why I need to know my anatomy. I have a patient that has diabetes and renal failure. Now I know why I need to understand the physiology of the kidney. So we start taking the academic portion, the didactic portion, and we put it to real-life application. And what better to learn than both have both the real world and the book world? And you put that together, the light comes on.
And many students said the experience was both crushing and uplifting. Explain that.
The crushing is that I think it's almost like what we do in the military. The program is designed to be tough. Break them down, have them look into the mirror, validate themselves, find out what their positives and negatives is. Don't focus on the negatives. Try to make the positives stronger, and then we build them up. You know, we teach them that they can do this. The only limitation they have is a limitation they put them on themselves. The only validation they need is their own validation. Do not let anybody tell you what you cannot do in life, because the people that are telling you what you cannot do are the ones that have the skeletons in their closets. Maybe they can do it. Don't let them define yourself. And so when we do all this stuff, the jungles, the 20-hour days, the academics, the tests, the spinning, all that stuff, the exposure is to show them the reality. That's the crushing, is the reality. Is the reality of the opportunity, the reality of the world. And then the uplifting is that we teach them that they can do this.
What do you mean by get out the boat? Is that your motto?
That's a big quote. All my students from Duke to Cal Davis to Mount Sinai, even here in Alabama, everybody quotes me. They love my quotes. And one of my biggest quotes is getting out of the boat. I tell people when you get out the boat in life, the people that are successful in life get out the boat. And if you get out the boat, you're never coming back. And there's two literal sense of that. One is a sense that most people that are in life stay in the boat, they're comfortable, they're not going anywhere. They're from Boonville, Louisiana. That's their life. They have no opinion about Africa. They cannot have an opinion about Africa. They can't say a word about China. You cannot have an opinion about anything if you've never, ever been there, smelled it, seen it. Absolutely 150%. Shut up. Period. The kids that do our program, we say get out the boat. I mean, literally, once you get out the boat in my world, you're never coming back. You're never coming back. You're never going to be the same person. You're not going to be the same person in humanity because you see women with their babies dying. And the women's tears and their pain that you hear them crying, going, oh, God, my baby's dead. Them tears scar your soul, and you always remember that. You're never, ever going to be the same. So in life, if you get out that boat, in our world, you're actually going to get out that boat, you better be ready to go all the way because you're not coming back. There's no way to come back. How can you ever come back when you hear a mother, baby die and you hear her cries and her prayers of God going to talk about, Lord, I wish I can go back to yesterday when my baby was alive.
What word of advice would you give the aspiring medical student?
I think the words of advice I would give them is in life, it's not over until you cross the finish line, period. That's on everything. It's getting up in the morning. It's becoming a doctor, becoming a lawyer, becoming a journalist, television, fighter, pilot, whatever. Life is not over until you cross that finish line. And people don't realize, a lot of us, from the cradle to the rocking chair, life is an experience. But what you want to do is that you want to focus on the mission at hand. You can do it. I mean, 2 + 2 = 4. 2 + 2 at University of Alabama in Birmingham is 4. 2 + 2 at Alabama State is 4. 2 + 2 at Stanford is 4. 2 + 2 at Johns Hopkins is 4. It is the same book. It's how you apply yourself.
You mentioned that one of your goals is to inspire minorities to work in the medical field.
The reality is that when we sit down and we look at the numbers, and you can argue statistics, but the reality is that there are not a lot of black kids in medical school. There are not a lot of black kids in nursing school, PA school, and that's the bottom line, and that's the reality. And don't tell me about affirmative action. We're here to help minorities because the numbers tell you differently. When you look at LSU Medical School, and they got 135 students a year going to LSU, and 125 are white, 10 are from Chinese, one from Pakistan, and one black, you do the numbers. One black student comes out of LSU for 30 years, that's 30 black doctors. What impact are 3 black doctors going to do over 60 million black people in America? It's impossible. And so what we have to do is that we have to change this dichotomy and take our minority kids and start letting them be exposed to stuff like this now when they're freshmen and sophomores. Say, guys, this is what you got to do to get to the next level. This is what you have to sacrifice. I tell the students, you're not living for the moment. You're working for the future. You know, because the test you take today is not about today. It's about what's going to happen 10 or 15 years from now. And so we have to inspire them and teach these kids and get these kids to start thinking differently. And the mothers and the fathers of our minority kids need to start. We have to think differently. We have to have a different formula, because the formula that we have now is not working. It does not work, because if it did, we would have more black deans in medical schools. We have much more deans running law schools, more blacks running hospitals. And the reality, it's not. I think my mission is that if I can go another 5-10 years from now and get 1,000 of our beautiful black boys and girls to do our program, and we put out 1,000 of these doctors and develop 1,000 doctors, they're going to go out there and they're going to train another 1,000 doctors and another 1,000 and another 1,000. And then once we get the seed planted, and we watered it and we give it sunshine, they all going to grow up to be big flowers. And I think at that time, I have crossed the finish line. And I will go home and I will read my book.
ASU's Department Chair of Biological Sciences and Executive Director of ASU's Topeka Fellows, Dr. Karen Sism Gunn, says her personal and professional life has been enriched by the experience.
When I came back as a different educator. I came back with a different perspective on humanity. I came back with a sense of realizing this is an opportunity like nothing else in all of my time at ASU, the kinds of opportunities that we've been able to try to bring forward for our students. This is something unlike anything else that we've tried to do, because it's a 360-degree training experience. We went spinning. We would go to the hospital in the morning, have hospital rounds, all of these responsibilities. By that evening, we would go to a gym and we would be spinning. And the whole purpose behind that was, are you going to quit on your patients? Gut it out. Keep going. Don't sit down. Stand up and spin. Are you going to quit on your patients? And that was the kind of mindset that was translated to the students. Sometimes when you're in an uncomfortable zone, you have to push through, because it's not just about you. There's somebody's life, there's somebody's well-being, there's somebody's family well-being at stake, because if someone's ill and they're not able to work in Peru, there's no social systems there to take care of people, okay? So what you earn is what you live out of. So if there's a mother who's got five children and she's working in the Bailin market, but she has her foot amputated and she can't go, that whole family is now hanging off of a cliff. It impresses upon the students, it's bigger than just dispensing some medical attention. There's more to this patient than this foot that's got to be amputated. There's a whole family history and a whole family dynamic that's involved with this. And so from that perspective, I came back changed. Because it helped me to understand, now here we are, we have this responsibility for preparing these students to go off into the medical profession. What are we really preparing them for? American students, admittedly, when they aspire to go to medical school, they see the glitz, they see the swag, they see the dazzle, they see all of that, but they don't really understand the implications behind what they've declared their lives to be, what the service that they've decided that they are participating in, and what the implications are. This 85-year-old grandmother, this 4-year-old child, this, you know, father of 7 children who's the breadwinner for the family. You're not just treating a disease. You're inserting yourself into a whole family dynamic. And those are the kinds of lessons that the students came back armed with. You know, a lot of what we do involves grant funding, okay? There are institutions all over this nation that recognize that we've got disparities in our workforce, in the STEM workforce. So we're going to approach the government and get these federal dollars so we can develop these glowing training programs and invite all of these minority students over the summer. We're talking, and I don't want to call institutional names because it's an issue within this country, but you have major research institutions that will get all of these federal dollars and invite these students summer after summer, summer internship program. My email gets blown up with these opportunities. Send your students, do this and do that. Well, the student from sophomore year, junior year, senior year takes advantage of all of these activities, all of these summer opportunities, and they start getting excited. When I finish, you know, I got a shot at going to X university or Y university or Z university. Once they graduate, then they send an application for admittance to a PhD program, for admittance to medical school, and guess what happens? They get denied. But they are used as numbers very often to fill these seats so that these universities can get these underrepresented dollars, and, oh, we're doing a great thing, and we're doing our piece to try to bring diversity to the U.S. workforce, but then the admission doors are closed when it's time for those students to actually walk into a degree program. And so that's very disconcerting to me. It's very disconcerting to me. But this opportunity, the Tepeda opportunity, there's obviously a different mindset and a different philosophy behind it. Dr. Rowling has invested a lot of his own personal sweat equity because he's a product of the system. He understands the challenges that our students face in trying to further their dreams and to try to gain access to these big programs, if you will, and seen the kinds of frustrations that mount amongst our students, because you mean to tell me I was talented enough for you to invite me back every summer, but now that I've graduated, I've got a degree, you mean to tell me I'm not talented enough for admission to your program? So there's a conflict there. And one of the things that Tepeda, this whole Center of Excellence concept that we're fleshing out, that's one of the things that we're going to address. This is an opportunity of us doing things for our students, preparing our students, creating opportunities for them, robust opportunities, armoring them not only with the organic chemistry and the molecular biology and the physics, but the mindset, the heart, to be prepared to accept the responsibilities of this professional field that they have decided that they are called to.
The Magnificent 10 participated in surgeries, infant deliveries, and amputations. They also hiked in the sweltering Amazon rainforest. ASU freshman Robert Ime, whom fellow students affectionately called Dr. Dark Chocolate, recalled the experience.
He's definitely showed us the importance of humanities, and he's trying to make sure that we know that when others less fortunate than us are in need of help, it's our concern and our responsibility to do our part to help them. So through going to different villages and blessing them with medical equipment and money and toys and supplies, you know, he's shown us methods to give back and understand what humanity is all about. So what I've learned, I can tell others about, you know, how we can, even in our own community, help those less fortunate, whether it's in a third world country or if it's in your project or your hood or even in the suburbs. You know, we have to kind of be aware and be socially responsible and just play our part and as a role as good people who try to help others in need.
Courtney Oliver, senior at Alabama State University, and I'm a team leader over at Chipita. The main thing that I learned from this whole experience, this being my second time, was it helped me broaden my idea of what field I want to be, particularly like neonatology or working in the ER, because the variety of stuff that's going on is just amazing. So it just broadened my scope of what I want to do. You see so many of the patients just looking up to say, please help me. All they want is some type of comfort, some type of reassurance. It's just the burden of trying to be able to do what you can, even though you have like a limited amount of stuff that you can do, as well as the like waking up early in the morning, going to sleep like late at night. So it's just, but overall, it was worth it, the burden. So the main thing that stuck with me was the humanitarian of the medical field. It's not about trying to just cure the disease or just get them in, get them out. It's all about the patient. It's about just not only helping them out, make sure they're healthy, but their spiritual being, that they're smiling, that they're comfortable, that they know that their body and their whole person is taken care of.
My name is Casey Martin, and I'm a senior at Alabama State University. We studied medicine. We assisted in surgeries, birth. So we did a lot of things. Oh, my goodness. We learned about the snakes, the culture, the food. The things that stuck well with me from Peru, I would say all of the smiling people, because once you know that they're finished with procedures or finished with surgery, they all have smiles. So that lets you know pretty much that the people are okay.
Melanie Hogan, WVAS News.